I want to make sure I have a community to lean on and to support through whatever they're going. So I think this trip also reminded me of how important that community is and how much more I want to keep building, not just for myself or for future generations of my family, but also for my neighbors across the states and across the world, where I want to make sure they have that opportunity as well to find their community in whatever shape or form that looks like to them.
Welcome to Door to Door, a multi-generational story of memory, trauma, and identity. I'm Miriam Terlinchamp. In this 5-episode series, we follow how my family, over 4 generations, metabolized a history of survival, trauma, and hope, and reclaimed a story nearly erased. This is our final episode in the series, Episode 5, What We Choose to Build. We all have foundational myths in our consciousness that drive our worldviews. The ways in which those stories are told and retold connote a sense of singularity that makes them larger than life, essential to our identity. Part of belonging to a lineage is the act of finding ourselves within the story, claiming a particular link in the chain of inheritance as testimony to our merit for inclusion. This is particularly true for those of us with marginal identities, shaped by missing information, a gap in biological data, and the presence of habits and coping mechanisms that equip the protagonist to survive against the odds. The shift happens when the story moves beyond the primary trauma, with the birth of new generations, and the effort is made to synthesize identity and disentangle from habits which no longer serve us. This is my mother, Nadine.
He left his mother and his beloved aunts behind, and it was something that followed him because he felt both pride and guilt at sending his youngest brother at age 14 to an uncharted land called Palestine, who was forever traumatized by it. So he was constantly second-guessing himself. But what didn't waver, and you've probably heard this in other interviews, was his strong faith in God. And that there was some kind of rhyme or reason to why we do what we do. But in terms of trauma, or as we talk about, what do we infuse or inculcate from his experience? I think it was a generalized sense of you need to be ready to flee at any moment. So a concern about financial security, a concern about what others think about us, a concern to make sure that we were surrounded by other Jewish people. This is a common response, that you want to live in a neighborhood or have your children go to school where you're not the only Jew. That's how I think we lived out those fears. Go look at the grocery store to make sure there's some Jewish foods there or holiday foods there so you know that you could live Jewishly openly. That's not something that we articulated. That is something that myself and everyone I know does when they want to relocate or when they're choosing a school or when they're choosing a university for their children. Are there other Jews there? And so I think that might be one way that we ingested and metabolized his experience.
It feels disingenuous to claim that this story of my grandfather's suffering, imprisonment, an escape from Nazi Germany is wholly mine in the same way that it belonged to him. Yet the experiences during the Holocaust have shaped Jewish identity and consciousness across all Jewry. There's no way to approach the current political moment or religious one without navigating a relationship to genocide. What does it mean to be part of a people who, in every generation, experience persecution? More, what does it mean to be part of a people who have not metabolized the trauma of persecution, but instead have passed from generation to generation, le dor va dor, unprocessed trauma? What does safety look like? And at what cost? How do we unravel the trauma from the meaning so that we are not just calling out never again, but also living that adage in all ways for all people? There is no singular Holocaust story, like there's no singular story of any other trauma. Each story belongs to itself and the way it is told and retold by the family who experienced it. This is Neil.
I would recommend everyone in our family trying to take advantage of the stories and the time we have to keep those stories alive, and also just to like reground ourselves in here's what happened, here's what it actually looks like. And that is still over there. We have all of our lives over here now. And these are such important stories to build on and remember and be able to tell, hopefully, our future generations as well.
There's something I haven't told you about Simon yet. Here's my cousin Shane.
After my grandfather escaped to England, he then immigrated to the United States and was drafted into the U.S. Army and going right back to Europe.
In the Army, Simon had a pen pal. Her name was Miriam. Letter after letter after letter in my grandfather's perfect lilting handwriting, he told her of the wonders of Europe, of finding possibility even in places dark with despair, and signed each letter with the words, "All my love, Simon." They met, married, moved to Texas to open a business, start a family, and live the American dream.
We've been mowing about a new state from Lintus Synagogue, which happened to be the very liberal synagogue in Houston, West Israel, very liberal. And it was Pesach, which is a Jewish holiday. Mm-hmm. So we went in there and said, "Well, the newcomers to Houston, can you help us?" And then was Rabbi Shaktel, very famous in Houston. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Stand aside, I have to talk. Shake hands with my congregant." And after he was finished shaking hands before the very illustrious synagogue, he invited to his house. It's unusual. Mm-hmm. Some strangers came in there. He was very friendly and was very impressed by him. And my brother-in-law got a job, and he introduced me to a lot of the influential people in Houston as his cousin. So I got a job too. We found an apartment. It was very hard to find an apartment in Houston. Then got started life here. I always liked Houston from the very beginning. Then things got out. Got a first house called GI House. At that time, the government helped you buy a house. Mm-hmm. Then we got a bigger house and things like that. And now making business for myself.
Somehow it actually worked. After a few fits and starts, Simon launched a company selling bulk coffee. Miriam helped him every day at work, and at night she volunteered for a social group in the synagogue. She seemed to collect all the city's wayward souls around her dining room table. Three children arrived, healthy and strong. They attended Jewish summer camp and played baseball. Despite the blistering heat, Simon grew plants in the backyard of their three-bedroom home on Wigton Street. He danced with Miriam in the kitchen. He wrote her love letters still. And he brought her gold charms to hang on a bracelet. She cooked his favorite foods and wore this blue dress that made him blush. It mobilized the women at the synagogue to give back to the community. They traveled with their children to the Grand Canyon in Colorado. Simon's youngest didn't even hear his German accent, so American was their life.
This is my father, Pierre.
My name is Pierre Terinchamp. I am Simon's son-in-law, and I've known him for many, many years. I worked with him for probably 10 years. I now live in Belgium. I'm Miriam's father. I'm at the end of my life as well now, but it's interesting to reflect on someone who has influenced you. Sorry to become emotional.
What's so emotional in this moment?
Good memories.
Good memories, yeah. I know.
When I think a lot about Simon, he's a person who taught me many things. He taught me how to adapt in a foreign country. Basically, you read the news, you get involved in the language, you don't forget your past, that you have to go on with life and what life has to offer in the new country. And that way you basically get more integrated faster. So to me, it was a very good time. So it's emotional because these are people I loved, I respected.
At the end of the biblical story of Job, after he lost everything, his home, his friends, his wealth, his family, God blessed Job by doubling the gain over his losses, as though more children, more wealth, more friends can make up for the pain of losing them in a miserable game of divine chance. For Simon, maybe those years in the Texas sun, being his own boss, living openly as a Jew, having healthy children, felt like a doubling of riches, a reward for being a person of faith and hope. Maybe he even allowed himself to believe he was getting his happily ever after. But this isn't that kind of story. Miriam became sick, something to do with her heart, and at 44 she died, leaving Simon to raise their young children as a widower in 1960s Texas. Back to Nadine.
My father was a single parent when it was less vogue than it is now. My mother died when we were young, when we were in grade school. And he was a traveling salesman, so we were on our own a lot.
He handled Miriam's death the way he handled all the unrighteous loss that came before it, but worse.
Here's Pierre.
Well, Simon had many negative aspects. I mean, till today, I don't agree with the fact how he treated his children with his new wife. But that was personal. People survive. People do what they have to do. I mean, Celia was completely nuts. And Simon never defended his kids. It frayed a bit our relationship. It was why we left Houston. It was a very negative aspect of our lives. I guess it followed us for a long time.
This is my cousin, Marika.
The traumas that all three of those kids experienced in that household, both intergenerational trauma from my grandpa's own traumas, their stepmom's traumas, and how those infiltrated the household in the day-to-day living, the nature of survival in that home of just like getting through the day, being able to afford to put food on the table and hustle. And my grandpa hustled, you know, he was a hustler. He was, whether it meant knocking on doors to sell clothes or whatever it meant for my grandpa at the time, there was a lot of trauma in that home. And now all three of his children, including my father, my aunts, I mean, it shows up in so many ways still. And then in my own body, how do I experience some of that intergenerational trauma? I notice it. I can notice the way it shows up in my daily, in the way I live, in the way I parent, in the way I show up in my marriage. It's all there, but I'm able to notice it, which is helpful.
It's one thing to take everything from a man. It's a whole other thing to make him feel like he's returned to life, that he is safe, that he is blessed, and then to rip that second chance away too. Simon burned her pictures. He gave away her clothes, and the name Miriam and the stories that went with her were silenced in their home. Simon continued to be a loving and kind father, and he remarried a few years later. But his will to make change and his ability to return from hardship was lost. This is my cousin, Mark.
And then creating this life in Houston, and his first wife passing away, and then marrying his second wife and going through all the turmoil of that.
Until the day when his youngest, Nadine, who was just 8 years old when her mother died, the girl who was raised with only whispered stories, the one forbidden to ask questions, the daughter fiercely loyal to her father, had her own baby. The baby arrived on an auspicious date in the Jewish calendar, Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. When Simon heard that Nadine was in labor, he fled the synagogue in the middle of services and rushed to her bedside. He reached for Nadine's firstborn. "What's her name?" Simon asked. Nadine didn't flinch. "Miriam." No one could say my name without thinking of my namesake.
Pierre again.
We had a discussion before you were born. Nadine was even. She didn't want to take part in complication or whatever. So she wanted a name, okay. And when you were born, we decided, call her. Simon started crying. Simon has a certain link to his first wife who passed away, having a baby linking him to that story was so important to him. So we did not name the baby Miriam for Simon, but for Simon's sake, that it really touched him very deeply. It was very significant for him.
They saw in me all those forgotten stories, the hidden price of survival. And so it felt like I was born with two souls, both the new Miriam and the past Miriam in a singular body. It helped, I'm sure, that I was blonde and dimpled, joyful and obsessed with my grandfather. It was as though I knew, even as a baby, that I belonged to him more than anyone. On Fridays, we'd go to Sabbath services together, just the two of us. We'd sit towards the front where he'd sing loudly. We'd walk the hallways and look at old pictures, one that included my namesake. He'd point her out to me, sharing tiny morsels of memory. And then he'd say, "Jews are responsible for each other." We all heard that phrase from him. It was the partner to his positivity. Forgive in your heart and take your inheritance of survival, your legacy of peoplehood, seriously. And we did. Here's Marika.
My grandpa taught me that no matter what you've been through, so no matter the level of trauma or, again, horrors, there's always a choice, right, in how you respond to the world. And I think that lesson as kind of a guiding light, I think that forgiveness became this huge part of his philosophy, but not forgetting. And so he transferred that, and it showed up again in my dad. It showed up through the generations. Choosing to carry hatred forward isn't getting you anywhere. It's not about forgetting. It's about forgiving, and that's possible. And he was able to believe in this idea that we can live with dignity. Yeah, I think one of my grandpa's greatest gifts that I feel and I can see in all of us, so through the lineages, was this deep understanding that while forgiveness does not mean forgetting, ultimately what it really means is choosing to build something better in the wake of pain. And especially right now in a world that is often feeling like it's crumbling around us, we get to choose how we build, how we build something better. And because I'm standing on the shoulders of someone who chose love in a world that gave him every reason not to, his story is one that you're like, how? What? You chose love? That's amazing. That's the kind of legacy that can change lives. And all the songs and all of the cultural artifacts around us that speak to this concept that seems so broad and almost unbelievable, I actually think is what is going to change lives. And it's definitely what changed mine. And it is what allows me to live and raise a human right now in a world that is pretty scary to be raising the next generation in. But it's that I have in my lineage, in my ancestry, this really profound lesson that if we choose love, even when everything around us tells us that's totally crazy, that is the legacy of his story to me, and the legacy that I'm trying to instill in my own family, in my own child, in my own daughter, that with resilience and love and the choice of kindness and how we treat people, that is kind of the gift of his story.
What the story means to us in every generation changes. It is handed to us, then shaped by us, and we get to decide what it means for each of us in our own time. Here's Dr. Sarah Crane, visiting professor at the University of Cincinnati in Holocaust and Genocide Studies.
We should take the fact that it can mean multiple different things, has meant multiple different things, and that there is a rebuilding that happened there. Like, it isn't just a story of suffering, because that doesn't speak to the many decades that came after. But it's a story of a historical kind of fact and reality and discomfort that's never gone away. And these things just exist together. That every family member who comes after has to confront the darkness themselves as well. but then also acknowledge all of the efforts that have been done in the aftermath. What I'm trying to emphasize is that the story is different parts, and there are different things to be taken away from each part. And some of it is darkness and destruction. And some of it is sitting with darkness and destruction and living life anyway.
Here's Jackie Canjado, the CEO of the Nancy and David Wolf Holocaust and Humanity Center.
There's like a level of stamina to be able to hold the tragedy singularly and, you know, really allow that to create a deeper level of appreciation for resilience. That's a hard thing to do. I think people who get the most out of that experience have the capacity to do that. I just think so often Holocaust education is so boiled down into black and white and oversimplified that we can come in with expectations about what we're going to learn, and this is the same story we've heard, and that cuts off the opportunity to be transformed. So I think best case scenario, we have visitors who come in with an appetite for complexity and an appetite to feel challenged personally and an appreciation for the fact that there was a lot of complexity.
And Dr. Sarah Crane again.
There is not one explanation for why this happened at the time that it happened in the way that it happened. But I think it teaches us some interesting lessons about social solidarity, about the way that people understand themselves in national communities. I think it teaches us the power of public discourse to describe other people, other agendas, the kind of temptations of polarization and of reductive narratives about why the world is the way it is today. I think it's very easy in those moments when the reality is complicated to reach towards easy answers. And I think these are kind of the lessons that we can bring into the moment. How do we talk about and think about the social questions that the Holocaust brings? I mean, I think I come to this question also from the place of studying these two trials that happened in the 1960s that were designed to show the extent to which the Holocaust was not just perpetrated by a small group of people, by elites, but was enabled by wide-scale social complicity. And I think the kind of limits and lessons of that is something that we can bring to our study of the Holocaust today, which is not necessarily, I think, a dark story. I think there are also remarkable instances of social solidarity, of stories of rescue, or kind of stories of possibility that people did find for themselves within this incredibly oppressive, fascist, authoritarian system of Nazi Germany. But again, I don't think we should take those on their own. Just because some people stood up to the Nazi regime is remarkable, but the Holocaust happened because there were many people who did not.
It took a long time to tell this story. First, it showed up in nightmares, then whispers, then in lectures and tours and visits to sacred places. We passed it like a gemstone, reconfiguring the setting with each owner, but maintaining the center truth. We almost never were. It is by sheer luck that we are here. And since we are, we better not waste it. Hold fast to gratitude. Remember that you are part of something bigger than yourself. And wrap this story around your heart. Walk with it in the streets and tell it as often as you can, as loud as you can, as resonantly as you can, until your voice grows hoarse with the words, never again.
Never again, never again. We need to make sure we prevent this.
That's way you honor what happened. And we actually believed in those days, never again, that if you make sure that memory stays active and that people live up to that memory, in other words, acknowledge it happened, much like the German government did, then it can't happen again. We know now that's not true, but that's how we grew up.
We do not get to decide what we inherit. Only what we do with that inheritance. Suffering on its own is meaningless. It's the story that happens afterwards, the way it changes us, that has meaning. Reverend Serene Jones shares, in trauma, when one is able to come to grips with what happened, not resolve it, not fix it, but to move from grief to mourning, is to move from a place of sheer loss to a place of acknowledging the loss. And this creates a space in mourning for you to make sacred the pain so that the rest of your life is transformed by it, allowing the possibility of a future. She said, pure grief just locks you in the eternal present. You can move into a place where it is something you can find a place for in your soul and in your heart, but not in such a way that it immobilizes you, but actually propels you into the future through love. I can't imagine a time when this story will cease to be resonant in our family. Perhaps that's because there's no way to explain who I am without it, and therefore cannot conceive of a time I won't yearn to turn this story over again, to watch it blossom in the next generation. Not as a seed of anxiety or trauma responses, but as a blooming family myth that allows for the choice to integrate difficult family stories. The legacy Simon leaves behind is less about this story and more about the fervent wish on each of his descendants' hearts to embody the lessons he imparted. Back to Marika.
My grandpa taught me that no matter what you've been through, so no matter the level of trauma or, again, horrors, there's always a choice, right, in how you respond to the world. And I think that lesson as kind of a guiding light, he was able to believe in this idea that we can live with dignity, we can treat people with respect, and we can always come from a place of understanding, of compassion rather than judgment. And so to have those lessons really instilled, and especially in these conversations I'd have with him, it was incredibly impactful. I think the pilgrimage for me is like actually in the daily of how I like continue to bring forward the lessons that he's instilled in me, and how when I find myself shaky in my own capacity to choose love or to choose kindness, that's when I experienced my grandpa. And that's the pilgrimage, like getting to that place.
To love in the face of loss, to choose life, and to make a pilgrimage to a place that will never belong to us, but will connect us in the lineage of our ancestors. Here is my sister, Julia.
I don't know if he ever realized how incredibly loved he was. And I don't think I realized until after he was gone how unique we were as a family to be able to love someone that much. Our world kind of revolved around making sure we were all together. And I don't know any other families that had that kind of bond, and I attribute that to him.
At some point, the life of this story changed from one of survival to one of processing trauma into a shared commitment to descendants through a legacy of justice and love. To sing out the prayers of the heart with full bravado, in gratitude, in wonder, and in hope. Here's Nadine.
I have a feeling my grandchildren will one day make that pilgrimage like all of us have done, because they are growing up in a family that talks openly about our history, about the history of other people around us, about justice and injustice, and that justice has to come with action, and witnessing is an action. Protesting is an action. Writing letters, making calls is an action. And they're growing up in that particular world. But that's a very rarefied world that I don't believe their contemporaries are growing up in. So yes, I think that they will in some way make that pilgrimage. It'll look different than the one I just did.
The stories you've heard in these five episodes have lived in whispers, in memories, and in the chase for meaning through pilgrimage across generations. If this journey moves something in you, if you've ever felt the weight of inherited memory or the pull to understand where you come from, let this be part of your story too. Thanks for listening. This has been Door to Door. Ohio Humanities made this episode of Door to Door possible. Door to Door is a production of the Institute for the Next Jewish Future and part of the family of podcasts of Judaism Unbound. Created by Miriam Turlinchamp, directed by Joey Taylor, produced at Monastery Studios, original music by Rich Hordinsky, and art by Katie Kaysner. Check the show notes for bonus material and resources. We'd love to hear from you. So you can email us at miriam@judaismunbound.com or find us at www.judaismunbound.com/door-to-door.